Hey, welcome to my show. I'm Schnoodlebug. This is a DIY podcast about making stuff no matter what. As always, this episode is brought to you by Schnoodle Video, your one-stop media shop. Dirty Tapes is a DIY record label established in 2011 by Daniel, aka Uplift or General Dirt, and Chris, aka D-Lo-Fi. I had the absolute pleasure of chatting with them both about the history and the future of Dirty Tapes.
Well, yeah, man, we just hooked up last February for the Japan trip, and that was incredible. Yeah. Really, really good to connect to all those guys, because I'd been in contact with like a lot of those Japanese cats like over the years through SoundCloud and through Instagram and stuff, and it was a real pleasure and an honor to like meet all those guys in real life. And a lot of those dudes like came from different towns, from like Osaka, from Kyoto, like all over, you know, Japan, like taking the bus to come out and participate, and so like, or the trains, the high speed rails to come out. So it was like super honor for that, and it was a great crowd. There's a lot of, you could tell it was like a lot of heads, and that's what like Fumitaki told me. He was like, yeah man, typically like we have these events, but like you got the real heads to come out for the show. And it was like a 12-hour beat session, man. It was crazy. It started at like, I want to say like 8, and it went to like 5 a.m. 6 a.m. so it was pretty intense. Like I'd never done anything quite that long. So, but that's just how they do, you know. They plan their events out there for like the last train, which leaves at like 4 a.m. or something, and the bars just push that. So
sick.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. For me, it was music kind of came, especially like electronic music and DJing kind of came a little bit later in life, maybe in my teens, like 14, 15. I kind of had always been into like just VHSs, and I mean, I come from a background of artists. Both my parents were dancers, and I'm from Russia. So this was like Soviet Union era times, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And so a lot of the influence that I, you know, was growing up on was like a lot of VHS tapes, cartoons, stuff from America that we would get bootleg copies of that would be like transcribed to Russian. And a lot of my, I guess, early aesthetic and like sort of choice for material and like for what I want to listen to, or like the type of stuff that I like, is more of like the warmer cassette kind of analog sound. And so that kind of inspired me early on. And then, you know, just playing with cassettes as a kid and like doing like little, you know, going on the radio and recording little mixtapes, learning off of that, and then just continuing that into high school, where I got into hip hop and MF Doom and started getting into Madlib more, and actually had a chance to work with Doom in 2006 on one of his singles. It was called Vomit off of his Parallel Thought EP. Parallel Thought was a duo from New Jersey that I went to high school with, Adam and Jeff, and they were the homies, and they knew that I used to like write graffiti. So I kind of got into hip-hop and music through art and through graffiti. And then, you know, I did that cover for Doom, and then that kind of branched out, and then I started doing more artwork covers for the crew of Parallel Thought. And they just actually put out like Tame One from The Artifacts, and so they were working with him back in 2006 doing Acetab Vocab. They actually did a couple of albums with them, but I was like always in the studios, you know, with hanging out with those guys and smoking weed and chilling and doing photography. Like I would just do like random photo shoots. So it was kind of got into music through doing these background little projects like photo shoots and like the artwork, art covers. And so that kind of led me into getting into hip hop more. And yeah, from there it was just progressing and listening to a lot of Madlib instrumentals, and then like buying an SP 404, you know, messing with that, just getting deeper into Tumblr. And I think that's where I sort of discovered Chris and Cleveland Tapes and the whole kind of underground music scene with like Stone's Throw and Leaving Records and a lot of those independent imprints that I was really, that influenced, you know, my vision for Dirty Tapes or where I kind of wanted to take it.
Man, that's exactly, that's kind of crazy hearing you speak on it in that way. And And I, you know, I knew you did some stuff with Doom, but hearing you, hearing it in a different time context, and even like,
I don't even know if I even told you about,
projects back in the day. I remember seeing, you showed me, you got like one of the copies, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember you showed it to me and I look, your name is on the liner note. So I was like, okay, you know, I didn't need, I just kind of put two and two together, but yeah, I want to say as far as like making music, right? I was in my mid-20s, but I was always influenced by East Coast hip hop, not even East Coast, but like whatever hip hop that I heard that was like inspiring to me. So I was always an artist doing, you know, just illustrating graphic work, just fashion and culture. So I was always listening to music, right? And I was just always kind of like my soundtrack to, you know, just my visual work, visual art and all that stuff. And then, you know, it was just a time where I was on the internet, just really influenced by just my own personal progression and just like experimenting with just different forms of art. And I came across, you know, just, there was just a really cool MySpace music sharing culture, right? It was just like, this is it. Like, and I felt like I could be included, right? Because it all felt fresh and it just felt a little fresh. And it just felt like I just wanted to participate no matter what, right? I was just like, look, this is super influential. At the time I was in Los Angeles. Me and Toy were together. Toy's a really good friend of mine. So we were going to Sketchbook. And at the time, Koopma was there, Rosh G, DiBiase, Flying Lotus, right? So we would go, we would literally walk.
Well, this is like 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
Like
this was like, seven, eight, something like that. Yeah. So, you know, we were super influenced. We were just like, yo, this is incredible, right? It was just like, I was just going to participate no matter, you know, no matter what.
I mean, we were definitely taking cue from like Leaving Records, Stone's Throw, Cleveland Tapes, you know. There was already sort of that fringe, you know, it was starting to peak out a little bit and we were just kind of giving it a nudge for the East Coast scene because like, the whole idea was pretty much like to take that ethos and bring it to the East Coast, bring it to New York, because we didn't have anything like that at all at the time. I mean, this was going back to like mid-2000s, kind of the end of the boom bap era in New York, and there really wasn't much of a music scene for that kind of stuff, like underground beats, and so it was kind of like a reemergence of that culture, but we didn't have anything like it was in LA with the beat scene and with, you know, with those guys and Leaving Records and Stone's Throw and Madlib and Dilla. And like, that's who we were kind of looking at, you know, as our inspirations, you know, and trying to do that and trying to do more of like a sort of leaving imprint where it's like super underground, where we're just trying to put out new cats that are, haven't really even had the chance to have the spotlight. So that was really for the underdogs, you know, kind of bridge that gap between the underground and like meeting people at shows. And cause it was like very Democrat, like it was just do whatever you want. It was like that experimental vibe of like, it doesn't have to be this way. It could be a little bit dirty. It could be like weird. It could be different.
Folks was just experimenting. It was just like influence all over the place. And a friend of mine, I'm just not sure. I know I came across Jared's work and Dan's work all around the same time, right? So I was just really
MySpace was like that first. I think I discovered you on MySpace, actually. That was the first thing, you're right. And then it went to Tumblr.
That was like before, you know, anybody sort of like created any, you know,
platform or anything.
That was
pre social media. I mean, that was like the dawn of kind of social media.
Right, it was just like that group. Yeah, it was like that kind of group collective energy of experimentation. But I was just like, yo, how can we do this in a more not that it wasn't legitimate, right? But I wanted to participate more like independent labels, like indie labels, right? Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love the kind of like punk rock ethos to where they would throw together really very DIY, very affordable ways to like aesthetically show what they, you know, it was just, mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of like mix that together because I'm like, yo, I really want to share this, you know, but how can we do this in the most cost-effective way, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I was just looking at tapes and I was like, yo, you know, that's it. You know, I grew up in the tape era of like, whether it's VHS or, you know, cassette is just like, yay, make your own mix, make your own vibe. Like,
yep.
Put that together, package it up, you know, and I was fortunate enough to have like, just be around some good community, right? So we had like, I remember St. Mark, folks was doing like cool stuff. So like he did a cover for me, right? It was just like a series of music. I just followed the template that other musicians like Madlib, Dilla, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
All the like my whole influence, like even DiBiase, Ross G, right? Flying Lotus, like I'm influenced by everything. Was like, mm-hmm. I was literally trying to absorb everyone's style. Like, just it was so fresh, and like I was just inspired by people's work. So it was really just like, yo, how can we share everybody's work in an affordable way? Really, mm-hmm.
And Daniel, you drove out to Cleveland to meet up with Chris in order to figure out the operation.
That's right. Yeah, I came in the winter of like, I think it was 2011 maybe. And that's when I had just pressed up the first dirty tape. It was the Twami Dink split tape.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so I was started doing the covers for them, which were block print covers, you know, and I like carved out the first sort of like Dirty Tapes logo. And there was like three different versions of that. And so I started doing these woodblock prints, and that became sort of the beginning aesthetic of doing those prints with the sort of, with that paint, like that smeared sort of paint style that we were doing with it for the J cards. Because every Twami tape came with a unique J card. It was like custom made, all different colors. And so you would just get a one-off. And I really liked that. The DIY aspect of like, yo, this is going to be something that's going to be a collectible. It's going to be a limited series. And this is touched by the artist. You know, this is something that is it's a piece of art in itself, you know? And so I really loved the creative process of doing these projects, you know, working with woodblock or working with photos or working with this or that. And just that was kind of the raw style was like the woodblock prints. So we were doing those prints, and I came out to Cleveland to meet Chris for the first time, because we had been connecting for a while on like, you know, on MySpace, and then he really influenced my Tumblr game because he was doing Polaroids, and that like opened up a whole world of photography for me, because at that point I was shooting digital, but I never shot film. I never really got into analog film. So Chris like was the one that really, he started doing some amazing stuff. And I was like, wow, this aesthetic is just so incredible. And it's warm. And it's like, just, it can't be repeated. Like, you can't create something digitally that looks like that. So it was a culmination of, yeah, just what I knew, my background in arts and exploring like analog. And so, yeah, I drove out there. We did a whole bunch of those prints. We made all those J cards for the Dink Twami tape. And that was kind of like the beginning of like, okay, this is it. Like, this is where we're going to go, and we'll see how it, you know, we'll see how it goes. But there was never any, to me, Dirty Tapes was never about creating like a business. Mm-hmm. I never really wanted to be a business. I didn't even want to sell the files digitally. I wanted it to be strictly like cassettes. Like, you just, there's 50 cassettes or 100 cassettes, that's it. Like, we put it out, whoever gets it, and that's it. Like, just a purely collect, like a collector's item kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Analog. And so I never thought about business. I never thought about plays. I didn't want to monetize anything. I don't want to make anybody any money. I just want to break even and continue it, because it was really more of a love of the arts. Like I really never wanted to be included in any business decisions. I just wanted to do art and work with artists. So yeah, that's a long-winded way of,
But going back to the warm aesthetic, like even the analog, right? Like I just felt that was the perfect compliment to mm-hmm. just like the cassette, the warm
yes.
sound, right? It was like also this very unpolished, visual aesthetic, mm-hmm. which, you know, seemed to go to pair like really well with like
mm-hmm.
what we were doing with the tapes. And I feel you, like I really understand what you meant by like the idea behind it was really just to
a pure idea.
We wanted a platform to share this stuff, right? Almost similar to how we were doing on MySpace, right? But we also wanted that feeling of a tangible thing and an object that you could like, just hold, and like it has a different kind of value. We all like to share our work or like sharing files, right? That was incredible. But actually like that tangible handmade object.
Yep. And this was in the era where that was all gone. Like CDs were pretty much out the door. Like it was strictly digital. I'm like, if we lose these platforms, where's this music going to go? It's only living digitally right now. And so I was like, we need to start archiving. We need to start putting this stuff out and having this be a physical piece of art that still continues like a shelf life after like the digital phase is going to go. Cause it was so many people jumping on board, and it was like, it's like, how can you discover all these artists? There's no way you can keep all this music digitally, is way too much. So like, how do you create something that's tangible?
The way you explained Dirty Tapes as kind of, this is an art project, this isn't a business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious about at the time, 2011, when you two were meeting up, at that point, had you figured out work and had that kind of regularity in order to be able to take time to do something that requires the patience and the work?
Yeah, well, I always had I went to school for architecture, so I had a background in architecture, and I was working full time, the whole time I was doing the label, and still am. I'm still a practicing. So I always had like a 9-to-5 job that I would do. And then Dirty Tapes was just a passion project. It was like a labor of love that I didn't care if I made money or lost money. I just wanted to kind of break even and put all of my creative juices into that, because I was doing kind of more corporate New York architecture, a lot of retail stuff that was just very boring. And I was just kind of doing it to get by. But my real passion was the Dirty Tapes and the music and the art. So I always had that as a background. So I had the ability to not worry about the money as far as investing. And at the time, it was really cheap to do cassette tapes. Like duplication.ca back in the day, like you could do a run of 200 tapes for like $350, and including shipping. It was very affordable, and nobody was really thinking about tapes at that time. So it was like, we could just do this and not really spend a lot of money and have it be, a labor of love. I think after a while that kind of got me into trouble with a lot of the artists, because a lot of these guys, they didn't have any other full-time jobs. Like that was it. Like, for some of these cats, like that was their whole livelihood. And I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, that I just kind of treated it as a more of a hobby and not really took it serious to be like this business where I'm like, okay, I'm going to set these guys up and they're going to make all this money. It was like never really about that for me. It was really just about, let's find this this underground sound that no one has heard. Let's put it out there and let's package it in a way that's really beautiful and aesthetically pleasing. And that was really it. That was the inspiration, is do these projects, but never an idea to build it out as a business and to have it be legitimate at all. That was like, I was like anti all of that. I didn't want that.
I just want to point this out. Like your aesthetic was like, very of nature, right? Dan was like, my visual aesthetic of Dan before I met Dan was almost like the Nature's Man. He's like coming out of the bush, you know, from a hut. Yeah. Like, seriously, like,
right.
Vibes of like one of nature, right? It's like, so I understand that, right? But I like, I've always had, you know, I didn't end jobs. Like, I'm an artist, right? So I'm just like looking for the next project, right? Yeah. To help on my life. And I'm like, I'm fortunate that I've been able to be creative enough to like sustain myself. We just researched, right? I found out about who we can get tapes for. You know, I made enough money at the time. I was a barista, right? So I was like, I'm about to spend this $350 to, you know, I've spent $350 on anything, right? Like, why not spend $350 on my own work? Right. I want to share this stuff anyways. So this is something I can get with. I can invest in myself. If I can spend $350 on myself and break even. Yeah. Like, I really just wanted to buy it so I could share it with everybody that I like respected musically. Right. I just wanted to be like, hey, look, you know, I'm one with people of sound. Right. Like, I'm here too. Like, I've made this work. Like, I feel like it's beautiful. I package it up for the people to like participate if they want to, you know. So it was really about trying to, yeah, do that. I did not look at it as a journey to like make a lot of money, right? It was just really I wanted to share art and make a few dollars just to support myself.
Absolutely.
But participating in it, I knew it would like the cost of like, just on a personal level, sustaining myself with it, it takes a lot. Like, there's a lot that goes into that, and you know, record labels are interesting, or just, you know, just managing, right? That's a whole nother monster that I just never really wanted to participate in. Yeah.
In terms of like setting up contracts with artists.
Yeah, exactly. It was really enough to like. I was just trying to manage myself, right? Just trying to manage my own sound projects. And I have so much respect for Dan because Dan really held down all of the structure of Dirty Tapes, right? He financially, like, he put these tapes out, right? You're always going to have, no matter what, you know, that's always going to come with, that comes with the territory, right? Of working with artists is just structure, right? And how folks see their work. We're talking about artists who have extreme passions about their work and what they do, and how, you know, so, you know, you're gonna have that sort of things, you know. So
yeah, and also the expectation of some of these artists that are like expecting to, you know, to break through and make a lot of money, and it's like, bro, like, it's not always like that. Like, and to me, I always hit artists and I told them, like, in the very beginning, I was like, hey, this is not really a business. This is not a legitimate business. Like, you're probably not going to get a lot of money for this. We're hoping to break even on a lot of these projects. And if I can send you out with, I can send you home with 25 tapes that you can sell, like, on, you know, to your fan base locally or to put on your own Bandcamp, like, you know, sell those things for 10, 15 bucks. Like, you could still... Like, it was just really more of letting them be able to have it, those tapes physically, and to be able to sell them on Discogs, you know. After a while, like, I've seen some of those earlier tapes on Discogs for, like, several hundred dollars, and I'm like, wow, yeah. Some of those projects, like, really took off. And so they're actually pretty, you know, they've gained monetary value over time, which is amazing if you could do that to a project that, you know, and have it be sustained and have it still be sought after. But I always told the artist, I was like, hey, man, this is what we're doing. You know, it's 200 tapes. It cost me this amount of money. If I can, you know, sell all these tapes out in a year, it can be this and this. And, you know, like, so I think most people understood that in the beginning. Some people got a little bit salty at the end because they were like, you know, where's the money? And so it's just part of a learning experience for me. I'd never run a business before in my life, and it was all an experiment at that point, because there was nothing that existed at the time that was that, you know. It was just like, we're creating something from scratch. And so, like, when Boiler Room hit us up to do, you know, those Boiler Room shows, that was like, wow, look at this opportunity. And so, like, I was trying to plug everybody into that fold. And there was no egos. Like, there wasn't like, oh, I'm going to take these guys because they've got the biggest names. I'm going to use this guy because he's, you know, such a legend. It was like, really, like, no, this is who I really want. And like, I don't care if this guy has zero followers. Like, I believe in this music and I want these people to experience this, because it was really about like what I liked, what I enjoyed, and what I saw was like really great work.
If you're a member of my Patreon, congratulations! You're hearing this a whole week earlier than everybody else. If you're not a member of my Patreon, check the link in the show notes to start today. Going back to what you said there about exposing artists who otherwise just wouldn't, you know, mm-hmm. people that you liked, who was Black Wizard? Because I go back to that set constantly.
Dude. And
I can't find any information on him beyond that set.
Man, Wesley, that's Black Wizard is Wesley. The homie that we met in New York, that he's an incredible artist. But his other album that he just put out is called Diptera. Okay. And I think it's under Wesley, Wesley. And that, I think he put that out like maybe 4 years ago.
I'm going to look that up.
But check out, yeah.
And Wesley, Wesley is an incredible artist, period. Like, they're doing some, like, they're doing some sewing work. I've seen, like, they also do manufacturing. I've seen, like, table work. Yeah, so Wesley gets it in, like, on all forms. We're just talking about really incredible artists. Like, I feel like even Leland, right? It's just mm-hmm. like, yo, when I think about all of the people that I was able to connect with, like, it was... The connections were way more valuable than any. Yeah, it's just like I would have always came out on a negative and been happy, right? Even if I was negative on the investment, I would have always paid out to participate in culture that way, right? Mm-hmm. So
that was literally my bedroom. I was telling him, like, yo, that wasn't like
that was the living basement. In that boiler room. No, that was crazy.
Like, for 5 years, I lived in that basement, bro. Like, there's a lot of memories there.
That's funny.
So many underground shows that we did. Like, just it was fun, man. It was such a time in my life, you know, mid-20s, just having fun, man. There was no social media at that time. Like, we had like a little bit of Instagram starting to come out, Vine, but for the most part, it was all word of mouth. Like, to get into these shows, to know about Boiler Room, you had to be an artist, or you had to like be in the neighborhood, or it was literally word of mouth. So there was no like social media, like posts. There was no likes. It was just, hey man, you know about this? What's going? You know, it was just. And that's what I miss about that time, man. Because I don't think that could ever be replicated in this generation, in this new generation of music, because everything was so much more organic. And even with the algorithms on SoundCloud, like, that's what really built the scene, I felt like, is those algorithms were so organic and people would actually connect in a true way, whereas nobody was trying to get the most plays or what. I don't know, it was a totally different scene. And so purity of that time was really enabled us to do what we did. So yeah, I don't think that could be like, I don't think that could ever happen again in this lifetime, because the stars were just in, you know, in the right places. And it was just, I never even thought about anything like those projects. I didn't think about anything I was doing. It was literally just like, it would just come to me, and it was like super easy, and there was no, like, it was just, it flowed out, you know, at that point.
There was a bit of a hiatus, and then you came back with the Nipple Tapes anthology, mm-hmm. which is incredible.
Yeah, man. I'm like, I'm so thankful you did that, man. That's like Nipple Tapes.
I've been wanting to put that out since the beginning. That was like one of the first projects that we all were like floored when we heard that. And that was just the inspiration of that collage style that was so unique. It was kind of like what Anu was doing in the very beginning, like in early Anu stuff, just collage tape, you know, and even like Cleveland Tapes. But even going back to that era, like we weren't definitely not the only ones doing. There was like, you know, Paxico Records was in New York, so we were doing a lot of shows together in tandem with those guys. There was, you know, Bootleg Tapes, which was Rich's label, and was Astronautico, there was Grand Garden, you know, there was all these, the homies that have also were running tape labels that we all bounced off each other. And
I think that Black Wizard set, that was like a Paxico, Dirty Tapes mashup. Event, that was like, wow. Right. Yeah.
So we were all in the mix, man. We're all in the cut. So there was all these other little unique labels that were in New York at the time. And it was just like a golden era, I feel like, for that sound. And it was exciting, man. And it was like everybody was young. Everybody was trying to just play shows. Like that was the goal, is like, yo, where can I play my music so people can hear it? It was, you know, that was the goal for everybody. Just like,
yep.
Yo, where can I show my stuff?
Yeah, on a on a like a more egotistic, like it, with some egos, like, yeah, I really want to play this as loud as I can. Right. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah.
But it was all for fun. Like, we weren't getting paid for these shows. Like, I never got paid for any of the shows I performed at ever. I would just, and whatever money we did make, you know, it would be like a little bit would just be divided up. You know, people maybe only get like $50, $100 a set. And so, and people were like very happy for the opportunity to even be a part of it. So that's, and then after time, I feel like a few different things happened. Like, I just feel like there was a point where it got oversaturated, where the tape scene got so, like, everybody was doing tapes after like 2015. It was just like, it just felt like everybody was on that aesthetic. And then people, like, society changed. I feel like social media changed a lot of things, how people were listening to music, how people were buying tapes. People, like, and the cost of creating the tapes themselves and shipping had a huge part of, you know, a huge part of why the sales went down, is because, you know, I could, in 2010-11, I could ship out a tape internationally and only maybe pay $5 for that shipping. Now I have to damn near pay $18 for that same. So like the shipping cost is more than the actual cassette tape itself. And so you cut off like most of our, like I would say like 70% of our sales were international and 30 were domestic. Yeah. And like we lost over, I noticed over years, like it would be less people internationally buying the tapes. It would be more expensive. People weren't really into it. There was like too much of a saturation of people doing cassette tapes.
Right.
And also like society changed and music changed and people weren't really into doing like beat stuff and people were branching out. And so like my taste changed over time and I wanted to do more maybe electronic experimental music. That's why I was like hooking up with the Russian scene a little bit, because like I was really into that at the time and pushing more house music. When it was a lot of little factors, you know, like social media.
Things change, you know, like it's just like we did it. It was like, I was so thankful the amount of time that we were given to participate in culture in that way and all the people that we know.
I mean, shit, Chris, in February, like we felt that in Japan as
well.
Yeah,
that was crazy.
That's still there. Like, there's still a core set of people. Like,
actually, yes. Still a core fan in transfer, network. It just, that energy redistributed itself in Japan. Like, they literally have that. It's almost like how we view time. It's not as if time passed. It's like they're just using it right now. They're using that energy, that vibe of that aesthetic. They're really they're ushering it in a great way. Yeah. And I was just like, okay, yes, it's in good hands. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Like, it's gonna do some cool stuff. And you just never know when it comes back around. I was just always like proud of Dan for continuing to like document things, like, because that's really important, is like more than participating in it. So like in it itself, the documentation, being able to reflect and also like tell stories around it, and share that with other people. Like, that's the cool part about it. Like,
so I still have stuff on the works that will be released, you know, at some point in time.
Hell yeah.
Me and Chris's album, I mean, that's been sitting on the shelf for like since 2012. That's going to be a great release. Hopefully maybe we can even do that this year. And that album is going to be like incredible, because that's like a lot of DeLo-Fi early 2000, like 10, 11 stuff that no one has even heard, like that I've been super sitting on and like making sure no one, you know, it's not out anywhere. Some of it
might have gotten played in Japan, you know what I mean, but it's right. Really only been heard in on like a
live setting. Right, so no, there's a lot of projects I'm sitting on that will come out. There's also a book that I'm gonna publish, which is the photographic history of Dirty Tapes and the scene on the East Coast, like, because I, you know, I'd go to so many shows and I would always document and photograph everything, all the people's sets. So I have like tons and tons of from years of archive material that I want to publish into a book. And Chris too, and like, you know, me, Chris, African Diplomat, like we trying to do like a little photo book that's been in the works also for a while. There's like a Japan compilation we would love to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, I would love first to yeah. I want to tie that would be incredible.
Yeah, because we started, you know, we connected with all those Japan heads and we're like, yo, let's just put out a tape and do a collab, you know, with all those guys and have it be like Dirty Tapes Japan. And so many different artists, like Russian artists, American artists, international artists. I still have a pretty stacked archive of projects that are just sitting. So it's definitely not the end for Dirty Tapes.
That's super exciting.
Yo, I would love to find a new way to participate in in it, right? It's like, mm-hmm. you know, how we saw the opportunity with the cassettes, right? I just want to be open to different
mediums. Yeah.
Yeah.
How can we push that forward?
Exactly. To where it has to serve the same. It's got to be the kind of very like cassette ethos, right? It's like, you know, what I love about cassettes is that you can make it your own, right? It's like, You got 90 minutes, however long. Yeah, you just fill this up with whatever. You know what I'm saying? So I would love to find that kind of that same kind of vibe or feel, you know. So
I hear you.
Yeah.
And also Daniel, I wanted to talk to you about General Dirt, because I have to admit you didn't have the download links for those ones on SoundCloud, but I might have used to have them on my phone.
That's amazing, man. I respect people.
We encourage that.
We encourage that. Like,
dude,
do it all
I fucking love General Dirt. I can't get
Thank
enough.
Thank you, man.
And I was wondering if you had any plans for that moniker in particular.
Man, I did. Yeah, I do. I still do. Like, I still have so much material of General Dirt that has also to, you know, see the light of day. That's all like rips from like Sound Clash tapes, stuff that I downloaded off online, or things that I ripped and like bought physical cassette tapes of like these Sound Clashes from Jamaica from like early 80s to early 90s, you know, like 85 era to like 93 era was like the golden era for me for Sound Clash tapes. It was like I just love that sound. And I would just always be ripping and flipping these old Sound Clash tapes, because they were actually, a lot of that music never was released. Like, a lot of those things were just one-off takes that were played live also and like recorded on these like hour-long sets. So you could find really rare gems that like, you know, that you're not going to be infringing on any copyright stuff, because it's like literally it doesn't exist anywhere else but that tape. So yeah, that's in the works, man. Like, expect a General Dirt tape at some point.
Hell yeah.
From me, but it's there, man. All that material, I still got it all. So we hear that actually a lot from a lot of different folks. Is like, yo, you guys inspired us to do this whole thing, and like, it's cool that the Dirty Tapes as an idea, as an out, like a source, like inspired so many other little movements throughout the world. I'm just like, wow, this is, you know, just going to Russia or going to Japan or going overseas and having people recognize. It's like, damn, y'all, how did you even hear about us? Like, dude, you're all the way over here. Like, how in the world? And so I'm always like shocked when people like are up on it or know about it or have been influenced by it. It's just, it's really humbling to hear that. So thank you.
Just participate.
For the impact. Yeah.
Yeah. Participation is amazing, man. And I know we all want to like, as a person, as a human, you want to make money doing the things that you love. But sometimes like the participation, when you look back on it and reflect, that's why you need to document. When you hold on to those like experiences, those sometimes are way more fulfilling than sometimes the monetary value that you might get, although we need those things, you know. But yeah, the experience to me, like just being in Japan, brought it, just gave me a different look. It's like, man, you know, it's crazy. So I'm thankful.
And people are really like wilding out to have you out there too, man. It's like Chris gets so much love out there too. Like he's a legendary producer, and like not a lot of people really up on the lo-fi stuff, but that's like my bread and butter, man. That's like, that's how, like how you feel about, you know, the general dirt stuff. Like that's like, the lo-fi was such a influential person in sound and movement. Like, you know, he is pretty much Dirty Tapes. Like to me, like I was just trying to get on Chris's level, you know what I mean? Hell just yeah. Try to be like Chris.
But same, Dan was like at the time, I don't know if Dan knew that, but like I was hugely inspired by Dan's sound. Like Dan's tape for Cleveland Tapes was like, I listened to that tape, that song, like whenever, like I that was just my soundtrack. You know what I mean?
All of that
stuff was just, my soundtrack.
Somehow, so Chris, man, we gotta get that tape out sometime soon.
Yeah,
man.
I'm ready for that. We absolutely. Yeah. We can pull the trigger on that anytime. Like it's just like that's ready. Yeah, yep. Whenever you know, it'll find the light. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
You can follow Daniel and Chris, as well as the Dirty Tapes label, through the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to the Schnoodlebug Show. Spread the word, tell your friends, and go make stuff.